From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson at Texas Public Radio in San Antonio today.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in Boston. It's Here and Now. Major decisions today from the U.S. Supreme Court on housing discrimination and the Affordable Care Act, which has faced numerous challenges since first enacted more than 5 years ago.
And in the latest challenge today, the high court upheld the tax subsidies which help people afford health insurance under Obamacare, even in states that don't have their own exchanges. President Obama spoke about the court's decision soon after the ruling came out.
There can be no doubt that this law is working. It has changed and in some cases saved American lives. It set this country on a smarter, stronger course. And today, after more than 50 votes in Congress to repeal or weaken this law, after a presidential election based in part on preserving or repealing this law, after multiple challenges to this law before the Supreme Court, the Affordable Care Act is here to stay.
The Affordable Care Act is here to stay. Justices also upheld a tool used to fight housing bias in a case out of Dallas. We're going to hear about that in a minute, but let's get to the Affordable Care Act case first with NPR's Ron Elving. Ron, a big victory for the Obama administration. You can hear it in his voice.
Absolutely. The president has never seemed happier, although he seemed to be restraining himself emotionally so as not to appear to gloat. He did, however, cover all the ground you would expect him to cover, saying what he thought the law is, why it had been challenged, how the Republicans had fought against it politically, including the 2012 presidential election, and now most recently with this court case. And he seemed to be saying, it's done, it's over, get over it. This is the law of the land. Let's move on and make it work.
And remind us about this case and what this ruling means for the Affordable Care Act, if anything, at this point, or did things just continue as they are?
Things continue as they are. There will be more developments with respect to Obamacare. The system will continue to evolve, at least over the next couple of years throughout the rest of the Obama administration. There could be changes in the future of a more radical kind, particularly if Republicans have the White House and majorities in both chambers of Congress in 2017 or later on. It's not to say it will never in any sense change, but it does mean it will continue to grow and evolve along the lines of what it is today, with state exchanges where established by the state, with federal exchanges where the states have, for one reason or another, not established their own. And in those cases, as well as in the state exchange cases, tax subsidies can be given to those of low income or moderate income who cannot otherwise afford health insurance. So that aspect, which was the target of this particular court case, that element will remain in place and inviolable. There really will be no other way to go after that in the courts. It will have to be done through a political or a legislative process down the road. And by then, so many people are going to be part of Obamacare, far more than the 16 million who have been added up to now. It's going to be extremely difficult to do it politically, legislatively.
And in the decision today, this was a 6-3 decision. This was the second vote of support for the Affordable Care Act from the Chief Justice, John Roberts, who we remember was appointed by President George W. Bush. He upheld the law in 2012. He was part of that group of justices and once again voted with his liberal colleagues on this one. What do you make of that with Chief Justice Roberts siding with the liberals?
Let's make it clear that Chief Justice Roberts is not part of the liberal bloc. He's part of the conservative bloc on the great majority of decisions. He was appointed, as you say, by President Bush. He is seen as a strong conservative on the court. But he is also seen as a person who tries to divine or discern what the legislative intent of any particular law he's testing actually was, what it might have been, what was in their minds. And even though the language here says, quote, established by the state, unquote, four pretty simple words, even though it says that, most everyone who is involved in the process has acknowledged that the intent was to say established by the state or by the backup to the state, which is made clear in many parts of the law. Chief Justice Roberts, in his opinion today, cited many different parts of the law that clearly bear that out. So he was essentially the advocate today for the intent of the people who designed and passed the Affordable Care Act.
And there was a notable dissent from Justice Antonin Scalia. He said we should start calling this law SCOTUS care.
Yes, he called it absurd to rewrite the law. He thought it was absurd to reason the way the Chief Justice did back in 2012 to call the penalties that penalized people for not complying with the law a tax rather than a fee or a penalty. And that was the way that Chief Justice Roberts justified his vote back in 2012. So he really went after his colleague, the Chief Justice. He really laid it on the line. He wrote a, I think, biting and satirizing and comic at times opinion today that clearly expressed how many opponents of this law are going to feel. They're going to be bitter, and they're going to think that it makes no sense, at least not to them.
And Ron, just real quick, what do you think the mood is on Capitol Hill right now in the Republican meeting rooms and perhaps at the campaigns of some of the 2016 candidates who really don't like this law?
If you hear a great sigh of relief from Washington, it might be coming from the White House and the Department of Health and Human Services. They're relieved at this decision. It also could be coming from the Republicans on Capitol Hill, because if the decision had gone the other way and Obamacare unraveled, not just for the 6 million who would lose their subsidies, but for the other people whose own health care insurance depends on this part of the law, if it had unraveled, they would have had to have come up with a fix and do it fast, or a lot of people would have been seriously inconvenienced and probably would have lost their health care insurance. That's a big political bomb to land in their lap with an election coming up next year.
NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as Jeremy and Ron noted, the Supreme Court ruled 6-3 in support of the Affordable Care Act today. The justices handed the Obama administration another victory, this time on federal housing laws, but by a tighter 5-4 margin. The court ruled that housing discrimination doesn't need to be intentional in order to be illegal. Joining us to explain is Carrie Johnson, NPR's justice correspondent. Hi, Carrie.
Hi.
Well, Carrie, this case originates in Texas, but it has to do with the Fair Housing Act. Can you explain what today's decision means?
Sure. The Fair Housing Act was passed by Congress in 1968 in the wake of the assassination of Martin Luther King, and it's thought to be a very important tool in reducing housing segregation in inner cities and all over the country. The Obama administration has also used it quite actively in terms of bringing cases involving steering by real estate agents of minorities into lower-income communities. And also, in the wake of the financial crisis, against banks that may have discriminated against minorities in terms of lending practices. So it's been an enormously powerful tool for civil rights advocates for some time. And today, in a bit of a surprise, Justice Anthony Kennedy sided with the four liberals on the court to uphold the use of that tool in cases where people prove or argue not only that they've been the victim of intentional discrimination, but also using statistics to prove that they may have been unconsciously discriminated against. And that's important because these days, housing bias and all other kinds of bias are a little less blatant than maybe they were in the 60s or 70s. And so the use of this data can help and help plaintiffs prove a case where they may not have an email or something on videotape proving discriminatory intent.
Right. And as you mentioned, it was a surprise, the 5-4 decision, because, I mean, this is the same court that has sort of whittled away at other civil rights laws, the Voting Rights Act and the use of racial preferences by public universities. But really, I mean, they focused on this issue of disparate impact. And can you just briefly explain what that means in this context?
Sure. So disparate impact is a tool, one of the ways you can prove that you have been discriminated against. First is demonstrating intentional discrimination. That is prima facie evidence that a landlord, an education company or the like has retaliated against you or discriminated against you on the basis of race. But disparate impact involves cases where you may not have that prima facie evidence, those clear statements in emails or on video. And in disparate impact cases, plaintiffs often will use statistical analysis to try to demonstrate that a government's decision, a landlord's decision, has been based on race when they don't have those statements on the record. It's very important nowadays because so much discrimination occurs in the shadows and is less blatant than it used to be.
Right. And in fact, that difference between intent and impact is really at the heart or at the root of many civil rights laws, isn't it?
That's exactly right. Although I'm hearing from people who have been trying to challenge disparate impact theories, conservative groups in particular, that they are disappointed by this decision, but they're not yet done. And we should expect more litigation on some of these issues, maybe less in the housing context, now that the court has decisively allowed this tool to move forward for civil rights groups in the Obama administration, but in other contexts.
Right. Well, last question on the housing issue then. I mean, even though this case, as we said, originates in Texas, does it have an impact nationwide, since it has to do with the Fair Housing Act?
It has a huge impact nationwide because it involves moving people into inner cities as opposed to in the suburbs. And so much of the argument we have now all over the country, not just in the Dallas area, but all over the country, about where to build affordable housing for the poor involves these questions of whether those folks can be subsidized to live in the burbs or in high crime, violent neighborhoods. This conversation is all the more remarkable because it's happening as we're having unrest in places like Ferguson, Missouri, and all over the country.
Yeah. Carrie Johnson is NPR's justice correspondent. Carrie, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
So a couple of big cases out of the Supreme Court there on housing, on the Fair Housing Act, and of course on the Affordable Care Act. You're listening to Here and Now.
It's Here and Now, and we are in San Antonio today, a city that is still famous for a battle that happened almost 180 years ago, the Battle of the Alamo. And I'm standing on the site of that battle right now with Bruce Winders, who is a historian and curator here at the Alamo. Mr. Winders, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us what happened here.
Well, that's a big question. We've got 300 years of history here. We have history as the mission, as a Spanish fortress, Mexican fortress. And part of that, as you mentioned, is the most famous part, is the Battle of the Alamo. It's a typical European-style siege, where Santa Ana comes to town, spends days encircling the Alamo. It's an old mission that's on the east side of the river. The town's is on the west side of the river.
And Santa Ana is the president of Mexico.
Antonio López de Santa Ana. And Santa Ana needs to control the town because it's a crossroads, it's a commercial center. It's all the things that in a conflict you've got to control.
How big was San Antonio at that time?
San Antonio on the eve of the revolution is 2,000 or more people. So it's a big population center on the Texas frontier.
And Texas at the time was part of Mexico, but the people in Texas were rebelling against Mexico after Santa Ana threw out the country's constitution and took away certain freedoms for the settlers in Texas. That set the stage for the bloody battle that has been depicted again and again in popular culture from John Wayne in 1960.
Just speak right up and call me Crockett. Don't bother to use my title.
To a new History Channel miniseries.
San Diego is taking the Alamo! The Alamo's lost! San Diego is taking the Alamo!
We've just come inside the Alamo.
We're inside the Alamo, and what we're in is we're inside the church. It's shaped like a cross made of limestone.
And what was happening in here back in 1836 on those days when the battle was going on?
There were women and children here during the battle that were in this room back behind us.
And are there a lot of people inside here at that time?
There are probably about 15, 16 of the combatants that are here, family members, about another 10. So not crowded, but you do have activity. So it's functioning as one corner of the fortress. As we're looking around, one of the things we see is we see a vest from the 1820s, 1830s that at one point supposedly belonged to David Crockett. What you see is that the pattern is European or East Coast, but the materials are actually, it's buckskin, has beadwork on it. So it's that coming together of two different cultures,
And by the way, you're calling him David Crockett. I guess I'm better friends with him, and I call him Davy Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier. And he died here at the Battle of the Alamo.
He did die here. And even at that time, he was beginning to be known as Davy Crockett. But he's David to me.
He's David to you.
He's Mr. Crockett to me.
There are millions of people who come here every year to see the Alamo. What is so important about this place and the battle that happened here for people to understand about the history, not just of Texas, but of America?
I think the Alamo sums up in many ways the struggle of America, the struggle of freedom against tyranny. And what strikes me is we often have visitors who come from different countries, and they will say, you know, we have a battle like this in our history. And so it's a universal struggle. So it didn't, you know, we kind of go, it's Texas, it's the United States, but it's much broader in context.
But the ironic thing about the Battle of the Alamo is that the Texans lost.
That's correct. We often have people who come here and it's like they're telling us something. You know, you know the Texans lost. And it's like, yes, we know that. But for Texas, the idea was, you know, these men shall not have died in vain, that their lives were important, therefore their deaths are important. And a month later, 6 weeks later at San Jacinto, what the Texans are shouting is they're shouting, remember the Alamo. And so that's the connection, where you essentially take defeat and turn it into a powerful rallying cry that gives you victory.
And now this monument is getting a big boost of artifacts from an unlikely source, the British musician Phil Collins.
The Phil Collins story is sort of become part of the Alamo story as well. And it goes back to Fess Parker, 1955, then later John Wayne. And so he was a young man in England, saw it on television, and he says, you know, I had two loves at that point, you know, the Alamo and drums. And then fairly late in life, he started collecting items.
Things like what?
Well, he started with documents, and documents that have to do with the Battle of the Alamo, and then started buying artifacts as well, muskets, swords, insignia.
And now he's giving it all back.
We had had a discussion about collectors at one point, that collectors, it's your collection, but at some point you've got to do something with it. And he said, I've been fortunate enough that I don't have to live off of it. So he said, you know, I want it to be somewhere where people can see it. So when he made that official, it made him happy, it made us happy, made a lot of people happy, because visitors who come here want to see something from the battle. And if they can't see it from the battle, they at least want to see something from that period. And that's what his collection is going to allow us to do.
The collection will be displayed in a new visitor center, part of a number of changes coming to the Alamo because of a change in who takes care of it. A group of descendants of the founders of Texas, called the Daughters of the Republic of Texas, have managed the Alamo for more than 100 years. But in March, they were abruptly fired, and the state took control of this piece of Texas history. Well, another thing that may be history is the Alamo's status as the most popular tourist attraction in Texas. It now battles with the Riverwalk in San Antonio, and that's where we are now. And we're here with Lewis Fisher, who is a longtime San Antonian. He's author of numerous books on the city and the Riverwalk, including American Venice, the epic story of San Antonio's river. Lewis, tell us what we're looking at here.
Well, Jeremy, we are looking at the Arneson River Theater. It's one of the signature elements of the Riverwalk. The seating is on one side of the river, and the stage is on the other. And during performances, riverboats will continue to go down the river, wave to the crowd, wave to the actors, and continues, and everybody has a good time.
Lots of riverboats, lots of tourists walking around. There are restaurants along the Riverwalk. What is the Riverwalk for people who've never been here?
The Riverwalk is actually one of the world's great linear parks now. It started out as the banks of the downtown San Antonio River. There was numerous flooding that occurred, culminating in 1921 with a 100-year flood that drowned more than 50 people. At that point, flood control was put in place, and it became possible to keep the high waters off the Riverwalk, and that's when things really got started here.
How important is this at this point for the economy of San Antonio?
It is very important to the economy. Tourism is one of the major industries of San Antonio, and the Riverwalk going through the heart of downtown helps give San Antonio a downtown that's much more vital and much more active than many other downtowns in the country.
It's a much more walkable downtown than some other Texas cities.
Yes, it is.
And a lot older than cities like Houston and Dallas.
Yes, it's nearly 300 years old. The 300th anniversary will be coming up in 2018.
And I should say, as we walk down the Riverwalk here, we're passing a Hilton on one side of us. There are restaurants. There's an Irish pub up ahead. And then lines of these riverboats that tourists are filling up to go down the river.
Yes, and this Hilton Hotel has a very important role in the development of the Riverwalk, because from the when it opened in 1941, for about 25 years, there was very little development. There were no people down here. But in 1968, San Antonio hosted a World's Fair, which needed new hotels. One of them was built here on the Riverwalk, and a second one was built farther down. And once they were completed, they furnished visitors the opportunity to see the Riverwalk, and things really got moving.
And this has become a model for cities all around the world now that have tried to do their own Riverwalks.
Yes, it has. We have had visitors, planners from all over, from Singapore, from the Israel, from Peru, Mexico, all the far corners of the world have come here to see how they can do what we do here.
A mariachi band performs as tourists eat their lunch along the Riverwalk. We had some Tex-Mex and margaritas at the oldest establishment here and met a couple visiting from McAllen, Texas. They came to see the Riverwalk and had no plans to visit the Alamo. I told them to check it out. You're listening to Here and Now. And the U.S. is doing very well in the Women's World Cup. Let's talk about that. The last time the U.S. women played China in soccer's World Cup, this is what happened.
Chastain will take it.
Go! Perhaps the most iconic moment in American women's soccer history. Brandi Chastain's shootout kick beating China, giving the U.S. the World Cup championship and setting off a big celebration on the field at the Rose Bowl. Tomorrow in this year's World Cup, the U.S. meets China again in the quarterfinals. It is the first time the two teams have met in the World Cup since that 1999 match, which was also the last time the U.S. team won a Women's World Cup. Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the podcast The Gist at Slate.com, and he's with us now. Mike, bring us back to that date in 1999 and what happened there.
Yeah, it's an audio icon, too. You hear the kick. I never really just listened to the sound. I could faintly imagine the sound of her ripping off her jersey, and there she was wearing the famous sports bra. Well, that was the culmination. The U.S. was the greatest team in the world by a wide margin against others, and that was where Title IX paid off, and it was a golden generation. And as you said, the U.S. women, though they have been the best team in the world in many rankings, and they've won a number of gold medals in the Olympics, they haven't won a World Cup. The big place where that World Cup and that generation of players is showing up these days is they're now the analysts on TV. And they are criticizing the heck out of the coach and the players, not so much the players, but who the coach picked to be on the team and what Coach Jill Ellis is doing. Jill Akers, a mainstay of that World Cup team, she even won a World Cup beforehand, said that if she, Jill Ellis, is pleased with the way we played tonight, this was after the Columbia game, then what the hell is she doing coaching our U.S. team? And Julie Foudy, who's on ESPN, has also been saying the U.S. has to do a number of changes because the U.S. offense looks really, really bad.
Well, do you expect that the U.S. will make those changes and do well against China?
Well, here's I do expect they have been forced into some changes because a couple of their players collected two yellow cards, and that means they have to sit out a match. Important players, Megan Rapinoe and Lauren Holiday. So the big question is, what are they going to do for offense? Hope Solo, goaltender, looks great. Their back line looks great. But not only are they not putting the ball in the back of their net, they're not getting the chances. Their midfield is not generating the same number of chances that the other great teams are, that other great U.S. teams are. And then a lot of it comes down to the greatest goal scorer in U.S. history, Abby Wambach. But is she old? Is she I hesitate to say washed up, but, you know, she took the first penalty kick, the kick that could have gone up 1-0, and she just pushed it wide of the net in the Colombia game. She took it with her off foot, which seems a weird choice. She has not been good in any of these games. Maybe it's unfair for all of this to fall upon this somewhat aging star. Maybe they need to put three attackers up to help Wambach.
And I was looking at who else is left and the quarterfinal matches, and it's like a who's who of the richest countries on earth. It's Germany playing France, Australia and Japan, and England and Canada. It's like the G7, yeah. I think.
Yeah, we're not even extending to the G20, which actually, by the way, tells you about the state, especially of women's soccer, because it's a poor people's game in a lot of the world, but not with women's soccer. Brazil was an upset. Germany looms. I think the United States will beat China, but you got to watch out for Germany in the semis. If the U.S. offense doesn't start to look better, we're in trouble.
Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst, talking with us about the Women's World Cup, the U.S. and China going at it tomorrow. Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome.
President Obama has begun his final push to close the Guantanamo Bay prison camp in Cuba that holds detainees captured in the so-called War on Terror. Defense Secretary Ash Carter was asked by CBS this week whether he's confident that push will be successful.
I'm not confident, but I am hopeful. I think we'll have a good proposal, and we're hoping it wins the support that it needs in Congress so that we can move forward.
Molly O'Toole is politics reporter for Defense One, and she's been writing about Guantanamo. She joins us now to talk about it. And Molly, can you explain to me what Ash Carter means when he says he's not confident but hopeful?
Well, what the defense secretary means, I believe, is that it's very difficult to take bets on closing Guantanamo. Obviously, it's become such an intractable issue politics-wise, policy-wise, logistically, that both President Bush and President Obama haven't been able to achieve the goal of closing Guantanamo. The Republican majority Congress, with the exception of Senator John McCain, most of them want to essentially kill Obama's effort once and for all to close the prison. They want to run out the clock until he leaves office. The Islamic State has complicated efforts because people point to the rise of that terrorist group to say this is not the time to be transferring detainees to other countries with the risk that they could get back involved in the fight. But there are a few things working for them, which I believe is the reason he said, I'm not confident, but I'm optimistic. Ash Carter himself, the defense secretary, is very involved in this effort, which is somewhat unprecedented. He's very well trusted on the Hill. In addition, Senator John McCain, he's still the national security leader for the Republican Party. And while most of his party opposes Obama's efforts, he's been a longtime supporter of closing Guantanamo. And he's now in a position where he can affect some change, where he can do something about it. He's the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, which controls the annual defense authorization bill. And that sets the policy. And that bill, it's a massive bill that's considered must pass. It's been the vehicle for restrictions and battles on Guantanamo over the years. So it's really the key to unlocking the U.S. law that bars transfers to the United States, which is really the last main obstacle to Obama's efforts to close the prison, because the so-called worst of the worst that would be left, that can't be transferred to other countries, that can't be prosecuted, would need to be moved to a facility in the United States.
Well, and in fact, as you report, Senator McCain worked language into the 2016 defense authorization bill that would allow the president to move the remaining Guantanamo prisoners and close the detention facility if the White House submits what McCain has long wanted, which is a plan on how it's going to do so. And both the president and Defense Secretary Carter have met with McCain, saying a plan is in the works. So do we know anything about what's in the plan?
The irony here is that while the White House and Congress point fingers at each other, with lawmakers saying, if you want to get this done, why won't you give us a plan to get this done? And the White House saying, well, all you've done for 6.5 years is pass laws that prevent us from doing so. The rough outlines of a plan have actually existed for about a decade, even predating the Obama administration. So while the White House isn't speaking to details, we know in a lot of ways what it would look like, which is you prosecute as many as you can. There are 116 remaining now. 51 have been cleared for transfer to third-party countries. Paul Lewis, who's the envoy for Guantanamo closure at the Defense Department, has told us that he has a plan for each of them, which is not to say that he could move them all tomorrow, but there is a plan. And then the ones that remain would be transferred to a maximum security facility in the United States, likely run by the Department of Defense, where they would essentially continue to be held as they are now at Guantanamo as enemy of war combatants, which would be in indefinite detention. So that's what the plan looks like. It's what it's looked like all along. And that's likely the most feasible plan moving forward, as Senator McCain has suggested.
But, you know, as we were talking about earlier, there seems to be very little possibility, again, echoing Secretary Carter's not confident but hopeful thinking, that anything is actually concrete is going to change because, as you report, John McCain's proposal is unlikely to survive, and that also, even though the administration is at work on, you know, forwarding this plan that, as you were saying, exists, at the same time, the president has vowed to veto the bill because it does require that he submits a plan, which he sees as a restriction on executive branch power.
Right.
So how do all these efforts, which seem to be at cross currents, how is it all going to work out?
Come together. It's hard to see. I mean, certainly the Obama administration is reluctant. I think this is part of the reason why they've been pretty tight-lipped about this, to even acknowledge that they're working on this plan, though the defense secretary obviously has been speaking to it, is because they do believe that requiring them to submit a plan is acknowledging or allowing Congress to infringe on their authority to deal with detainees in the war on terror. And this has been a broader dynamic between Congress and the White House all along. But what it also does is it would lock in President Obama and likely whoever follows him into the White House into a detention policy, which is something that the U.S. has really been avoiding since 9/11. It's been described as very sort of ad hoc. So in this obsession and focus so much on Guantanamo, the prison, there hasn't been so much focus on our detention policy. No one seems to be answering the question of what happens after Guantanamo. And that's part of the administration reluctance in giving this plan. But there are just a few things working with him. Like we said, Carter and McCain are on board, and they're both working for this. There's also the fact that the Obama administration has managed to transfer more than half of the population that Obama came into office with. He started with 240. He's down to 116. He transferred 126. And the lower that population gets, the more astronomical the cost to detain at Guantanamo. It's roughly $3 million now per detainee per year at Guantanamo versus about 70,000 at a maximum facility in the United States. And if you identify as a fiscal conservative, that's a fairly compelling argument. And the smaller that population gets, the harder it is also to make the argument that they shouldn't be transferred to the United States. It's much more digestible for lawmakers if that population is very small, which is part of the Obama administration's goal.
I take your point, but just in reading your reporting and hearing you describe all the forces at play here, it does still feel like a lot of running to stand still, you know, in terms of final decisions on what to do about Guantanamo.
Oh, certainly. But the reason this is happening now is because Obama doesn't have a choice. This is his last best chance, not necessarily because the odds are the best, but because he has no other chance. If they don't get it done this term, the Republicans are eager to pass language in the NDAA that would essentially freeze the prison and doom any chance Obama could have. We've also got the run-up to the 2016 elections coming soon, and a lame duck president will become even more lame. So this is really it. And we could be talking about a matter of weeks. The Senate and the House are in conference to wed their two versions of the NDAA now. And their stated goal is to get that bill to Obama's desk before the August recess. So that could be in a matter of weeks. And that would likely force Obama into a veto and start kick off a kind of vicious cycle around this defense authorization bill with vetoes that's likely to expend remaining political capital that he has left, which isn't much.
Well, finally, Molly, you actually remind us in your reporting about another major factor that's at play here now that maybe wasn't even a couple years ago, and that is the so-called Islamic State. And in the videos that ISIS has been putting out, where they feature grotesque executions of prisoners that they dress in orange jumpsuits, which, you know, look to echo the orange jumpsuits that Guantanamo prisoners or Guantanamo detainees also wear. So, I mean, how potent does Guantanamo continue to be as a symbol and now as a propaganda tool for groups like ISIS?
We've seen it with Al-Qaeda and now particularly with the Islamic State, that they've been invoking Guantanamo, whether symbolically using the orange jumpsuits. There's reporting that they have waterboarded their hostages in kind of a direct allusion to those controversial practices, interrogation practices conducted by the U.S. in the past. And the administration uses the Islamic State, their invoking of Guantanamo, as an argument for, let's take this off the table. Let's not give them yet another recruiting tool to reinforce the idea that the United States is at war against Islam.
Well, Molly O'Toole is politics reporter for Defense One. There's a link to her story, Beyond Guantanamo, at our website, hereandnow.org. Molly, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now, and I'm in Texas this week in San Antonio today at Texas Public Radio. This is a state that is dominated by oil and gas, but it's also a state that leads the nation in wind power. But state senators recently threatened to end the subsidies that have paved the way for wind power to grow in Texas. That move has sent a troublesome signal to investors who say wind still needs support from the state and from Washington in order to compete. Reporter Lauren Madelon of Marfa Public Radio has this report.
Wind power needs two things that Texas has: open space for turbines and a fiercely pro-business culture that's favored energy development since the arrival of oil and gas. That's the sound of high-stakes commerce in the flatlands of West Texas. Wind is fanning turbines operated by North Carolina-based Duke Energy Renewables. Some of Duke's wind power ends up here at an Austin institution called Taco Deli.
Can I get a 4-ounce Roja?
4-ounce Roja!
The deli buys wind power from the city utility, Austin Energy, which gets it from Duke. The utility's customers, like deli co-owner Eric Wilkerson, can opt to buy 100% wind-generated electricity. He made that choice in 2005.
When we first signed up in 2004 or 2005, the price at that time was a little bit higher than conventional electricity, but we were locked in at that price.
So Wilkerson could look ahead, knowing one critical business expense wouldn't fluctuate.
We were able to budget and have the comfort, this is what our energy costs will be.
In 1999, Texas told utilities, put renewable energy into your portfolio. Texans also started paying about 9 more cents a month for electricity. That subsidized transmission lines built specifically to bring wind and solar onto the grid. Texas now gets 10% of its power from the wind. But this past March, a challenge in the state legislature.
Senate Committee on Natural Resources and Economic Development will come to order.
That's Texas Republican State Senator Troy Fraser in hearings on the renewable energy portfolio. He doesn't think Texas needs them.
There's no message here other than goal set, mission accomplished. We're going to remove that, but
Fraser's bill to repeal the renewables mandate passed in the state Senate. It wasn't considered by the House, so it didn't become law. But the conversation Fraser started continues.
Why do you need to leave a requirement in place when we have far surpass that requirement?
The chief electricity regulator in Texas is Donna Nelson, chairman of the state's Public Utilities Commission.
Wind has a really good foothold in Texas, and it's time for them really to start operating without subsidies.
That free market mantra is embraced by many in conservative Texas and elsewhere. This year, 5 other states have introduced legislation to reduce renewable mandates. But the End Subsidies Now movement is disconcerting for the wind business. Jeff Clark leads the lobby group called the Wind Coalition.
Our phone immediately started ringing.
That was when Fraser's bill passed in the state Senate.
Investors all over the world were looking at Texas and saying, are the policies going to change? Is my investment, is my long-term planning, my long-term investment a sound one in that state?
Clark says his membership needs the same kinds of support that oil and gas have long had in Texas, and no one's challenging those. One example, the state comptroller's office says natural gas producers saved $7 billion in the last 6 years because of exemptions in the tax code.
Our competitors have long-term certainty in the tax code. They have long-term certainty in their subsidies. They have long-term certainty in their access to capital on Wall Street. We have none of those things.
To get a better handle on the uncertainties of the wind market, we went to the University of Texas at Austin. Ian Partridge is a fellow at the school's Energy Institute.
I think if you look at what Texas has done, it's essentially been a combination of private investment in wind generation and public investment in the transmission system. That's something that other states really should copy.
This summer, the EPA will likely finalize its Clean Power Plan. The plan will pressure states to look for increasing amounts of renewables.
And in looking at subsidies and the future of subsidies for renewable generation, you're going to have to take that into account, because without incentives for renewables, they're not going to meet their targets.
This same debate is playing out in Congress. Last month, Republican Texas Congressman Kenny Marchant introduced legislation to permanently end federal subsidies that have meant billions for wind power. The subsidy was allowed to expire last year and not for the first time. But in his latest budget, President Obama proposes to make that subsidy permanent. All this back and forth, well, it's an issue. Steve Scott's the general manager of Duke Energy's wind operations.
Those of us in the market strongly feel that there is more importance on long-term stability as opposed to stops and starts. It is better for the industry if we have certainty around what that future is. And unfortunately, with each administration, there's a different spin on the energy policy. And that's something that we want to get away from.
Even wind supporters say that one day, perhaps within a decade, they won't need subsidies. But opponents say that wind's exponential growth means that day has already arrived. For Here and Now, I'm Lorne Madelon.
And that story comes to us from Inside Energy. That's a public media collaboration that focuses on America's energy issues. You know, Megan, you don't always think about Texas as a big wind state.
No.
I remember driving across the state, though, years ago, and you're in the middle of this wind farm for miles and miles as far as the eye can see these wind turbines. So it really is, and obviously some big questions as a result of that.
Absolutely.
Here and Now, a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.